You're listening to Indie Bay Radio here in San Francisco. Let's see, we are doing a series of interviews with each of the candidates for U.S. Senate in the Green Party. And so today we've got Todd Kresham. You've been supported by Matt Gonzalez. I ran into you at Matt put together an endorsement gathering for you a couple of weeks ago. And, yeah, tell us about yourself, Todd.
Well, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be on Indie Radio. And I first ran into the Indie Media Centers when I was up in Seattle in 1999, and when Indie Media first sort of burst onto the scene as the voice of the Battle of Seattle. So it's a pleasure to be here. Matt put that together for me a couple weeks ago, and, you know, Peter Camejo and Donna Warren and Amy Allison and Gail McLaughlin and Nativo Lopez from the Mexican American Political Association have all been very supportive of this campaign. And the reason is fairly simple for anybody who knows Dianne Feinstein, is that she does not represent California's progressive majority, certainly doesn't represent San Francisco's radical minority, majority, however you want to put it. And I think it's time that she really gets a real challenge. She's voted for the war, for No Child Left Behind. She's against gay marriage. You go through the list. And really, in my opinion, one of the most despicable things she's done is she's doing right now. You know, everybody probably saw George Bush on TV on Monday night, sending the troops to the border of Mexico, building a wall, declaring people's families will be divided based on how long they've been here. Really shameful and racist legislation. And Dianne Feinstein has been right next to George Bush every step of the way. And if you look at her votes right now, today and yesterday and the day before in the Senate, she is giving George Bush absolutely everything that he wants in this new immigration bill, and it's a real slap in the face to the millions of people who have been marching. So for that and many other reasons is why I decided to run for Senate.
Yeah, well, not least is which National Guard are going to be put on two-week rotations. They're not supposed to be conducting INS duties, and it's amazing. I've been listening to some of the other talk shows, and Ronald Reagan took credit for tearing down the Berlin Wall, and here's the new neocon display of building new walls while they push the NAFTA and so-called free trade, which essentially looks to be like they're going to lock the slaves in down there and make them work at 17 cents an hour. So, well, I tell you what, let's start with the trade agreements. Where would you stand on trade agreements? Why don't you talk about foreign policy and trade agreements?
Well, the trade agreements are a disaster for working people on both sides of the border or across all borders. And NAFTA, part of the big reason for the immigration from Mexico and El Salvador and Guatemala into the United States has been the effect of NAFTA. NAFTA has displaced 5 million small farmers in Mexico by flooding Mexico with cheap corporate corn from the United States and destroying the state subsidies that used to exist in Mexico. So you have the destruction of small-scale agriculture in Mexico at the same time as you have the mass creation of tax-free zones, what are called maquiladora zones in Mexico, where American, South Korean, Japanese corporations and Mexican corporations create manufacturing plants on the border and employ people for a dollar an hour or less with virtually no unionization. And those trade agreements, while they once in a while have some throwaway line about labor rights and human rights, the reality of those trade agreements is that capital is free to cross borders as it wishes, but people are not allowed to cross borders. And that's really the inconsistency, or perhaps it's the unity of the neoconservatives and the neoliberals all getting together to make more money for the big corporations. But there's a big fight, as you know, about CAFTA, which is the extension of NAFTA into Central America. Feinstein's been in favor of all these. And there is now, thankfully, a huge resistance going on in South America to the free trade area of the Americas. And I think it's dead. I think that between Lula and Chavez and Evo Morales, there is no way that FTAA is going to go through. And really what we see developing in Latin America now is the first successful pushback of the neoliberal agenda in the last 20 years. And it's tremendously inspiring. And we should learn from the struggles that are going on in Ecuador and Bolivia and Venezuela and Brazil. At the same time as recognizing that even though our government has lost a few rounds, the trade agreements are going down, they failed again in the coup against Chavez, our government has lost a few rounds. They have no intention of taking their ball and going home. I believe that they will try another coup attempt against Chavez if oil prices fall a little bit. They are going to continue to push because the American government and American corporate class's mindset is that Latin America is, quote-unquote, our backyard, and it has always been a place for investment and the taking out of huge super profits, and the United States will not give that up without a fight. So while we have to learn from the fight against the trade agreements there, we have to take some of that knowledge and put it to work here. So anyway, I think all the trade agreements should be thrown out and replaced with human rights accords and replaced with labor rights. Although I have to say that I don't have a lot of faith in governmental functions performing any of these. I think that if we're going to have human rights and if we're going to have union rights, that it's not going to come because a series of governmental agreements happen at some summit. It's going to come because the unions all over Latin America and in the United States and Canada, and of course all around the world, but speaking about North America, the unions in this country have to break their allegiance to the two corporate parties, primarily to the Democratic Party, and get back to what they used to be about, which was organizing workers. And, you know, it's funny because many of the unions have the word international in their title. So the International Brotherhood of Teamsters, for example, the International Longshore Warehouse Union. So the international concept is in there, but often that means just a few locals in Canada. I think that if the unions are to survive in today's globalized marketplace, the only way to do it is to spread internationally.
You know, it seems to me that part of the problem is the exchange rates, the fact that the value of a life on one side of an imaginary line, a national boundary, can be declared so much less than the value of a life on the other side of a border. And currency exchanges seem to be a huge problem. As you're talking about unions interacting to raise standards, whether it's employee standards, how would you deal with the problems of exchange rates and the value of a human life?
Well, the exchange rates, you know, we live in this myth that we're under a free market, and there's really nothing free about the market system that we live under. The exchange rates are determined partially by who's got the most powerful and technologically advanced economy, but there's also a big way in which the exchange rates are determined by military power now, straight up. So why are the Chinese and Japanese governments continuing to float the American dollar to artificially keep it up so the economy doesn't collapse? Well, the reason they're doing that is because they know that the United States has the biggest, scariest military in the world and has a chokehold over Middle Eastern oil. And Middle Eastern oil is not primarily coming to the United States. Primarily, it is going to Europe, it is going to India, and it is going to China and Japan. So the exchange rates really are not an effect of some amorphous, abstract free market system. The exchange rates are really an effect of imperial power. And the United States uses many different means, military, economic, diplomatic, the trade agreements, et cetera, in order to manipulate those the currency rates, in order to keep its own economy afloat and to keep its friends' economies afloat. So I think there's no way to sort of just deal with the exchange rates in the abstract. I think that what we have to do is look at what we can accomplish, and we're not going to have much influence on the Fed, on what the Federal Reserve does. What we can do is begin to build a political movement in this country that begins to put worker power back into workers' hands, back into students' hands, and that's what the Green Party is trying to do, is be a political electoral representative of that movement for social justice and for putting power back in the hands of ordinary people. So the question of exchange rates, I mean, a lot of technical stuff about how it goes into it, but it is not simply the case that these are abstract laws which function without human intervention. That the reality is that the most powerful governments in the world, the United States, the European Union, Japan, China, are constantly at each other's throats fighting over how those exchange rates will be determined. And, of course, the big corporations have an enormous influence over that as well. It is not an arena in which we have much democratic power.
Well, it's certainly the idea of putting together local currencies to stabilize local economies. It's interesting you were talking about the flight of capital, the idea that currencies and capital can cross international boundaries. In 1776 and actually up through the late 1800s, pretty much when the when that the corporatization became human in the late 1800s, there was a portion of it. But even almost until Ronald Reagan, the idea of banks taking their currency across state lines was considered. The idea that one state could create a colony out of another state, that New York banks could control South Carolina, that this was a huge part of the Civil War, that a bank could essentially invest, take the local currency and then, or the local money and invest it out of the state, out of the county, out of the region. Many banks were only chartered for per county. They weren't even allowed to a Kansas City bank couldn't, Kansas City, Missouri bank couldn't take the money to St. Louis. The idea that, Fresno, all of the money would be sucked to San Francisco or L.A. It's been really as recently as Ronald Reagan when they changed the banking structure and allowed interstate banking to expand in this massive way. It's kind of interesting because ATMs really create this ability for money to transfer electronically very quickly, and they're not even listed. Money through ATMs and credit cards are not even listed as part of the money supply. And it's a very strange idea that money can just flow all around the world as quickly as a matter of seconds. And so this idea of capital flight, are you about to cough there? Go ahead and give a good one. I'll turn your mic down there. Yeah, there you go. And, so the idea of capital flight, I'm not sure if you have any ideas. This is both a foreign policy issue as well as the idea of manufacturing and the impoverishment of the world.
Right. Well, I think if you look at the world today versus the middle of the 19th century, for instance, it's a good exercise in comparing who ended up being right and who ended up being wrong about how the economies were going to develop. If you go back and read Adam Smith versus you read, say, the Communist Manifesto, what Marx lays out in the Communist Manifesto, in which he was dealing with, there were big corporations back then, but they were still, compared to what we have today, they were pretty small players. Today, if you read the Communist Manifesto today, in which Marx talks about corporations will be centralized. There will be bigger and bigger corporations that will control bigger and bigger chunks of the economy. They will tend to merge together. The small, as you said, the regional banks will tend towards conglomerates. The specific industrial competition within branches of industry, and then will become merged, and then vertically they'll be merged, and you'll have this enormous capitalist monolith which will take over the whole world. And when he wrote that back in 1848, there was no capitalism in South Korea. There was no capitalism in Brazil. There was no capitalism in most parts of Africa. And today you see the entire world has been absolutely overrun by this idea that the only thing that matters to humans is the profit motive. And that is now overwhelmingly in the hands of a very, very small group of people and corporations. And so the system has developed, and that it is, I believe, will continue to develop. There will be technological innovations. There will be the banking reforms, for instance, are again not somehow because of some abstract economic laws. They are whichever section of the particular national ruling class feels like it get a leg up by pushing this reform or that reform. They always scramble for as much concentration as power in their own hands as they can possibly get. Sometimes that's by breaking down regulations. So you see the breaking down of the lines between the SNLs and the banks and the state banks and the national banks. For instance, Bank of America is no longer the California bank that it was. It's now based, I think, in North Carolina. And so that's going to continue and continue and continue. And I think that for us, for people who are fighting corporate globalization, there's two errors that we can make. One error is to believe that the states, that national governments don't matter at all, that they're totally powerless and all that matters is corporations. And I think that actually one of the weaknesses of the movement for global justice, which started, well, started before Seattle, but was sort of highlighted in the United States in Seattle, was a conception that many activists had that American sovereignty or state power was irrelevant. And the only thing that mattered now was corporate power, and that corporations could just overrun laws and do whatever they wanted. And I think that that theory of governments no longer mattering was really blown out of the water after 9/11 when the United States government came back into play big time by invading Afghanistan and Iraq and now threatening Iran, and the military aspect of neoliberalism really came back full force. So the first mistake we can make is to ignore the power of individual governments and think that it's just a question of corporations, or that somehow the governments are victims of the corporations, that in fact the governments and the corporations in the big powerful countries really function as a unit. The second mistake I think we can make is to, if the first one is to believe that only the corporations have powers, the second one is to believe that within countries you can't make any reforms at all because everything's just international now. So often you hear, actually my wife's a teacher in Oakland, and they were fighting to maintain not having to pay for their health care. And she voted against the contract, and now they have to pay for some of their health care. One of the arguments used to say, well, we have to pay for some of our health care, was, well, unless we have national health care, there's no way we can force the district to continue to pay all of our health care costs. And I think that that's a really bad argument, because it basically says, unless you can make this massive global change, there's nothing you can do to fight for yourself locally or nationally. So I think that we have to recognize that while corporations and the international economy is extremely powerful, at the same time, we can make reforms locally and we can make reforms within specific countries. So whatever happens in the international currency markets, we still have the right to demand a living wage. We still have the right to demand unions, even if the globalized corporations are taking jobs overseas. It's still better to have a strong union, even if it's only in one country, than to have no union in all countries. So I think that for people who are trying to fight for people's power, we have to recognize that it's not just corporate power in the absence of governmental power, but at the same time, those governments are not powerless, and that we can actually demand that they give us our rights.
It's interesting you say that, because just the other day I heard that Japan is withdrawing the charter for Citibank to do business in Japan because they're seen as an organized crime bank. That the organized crime has been using Citibank to launder money. And so that's a very clear example of one of the most powerful economic nations in the world flexing their muscles to Citibank is the Rockefeller Bank,
right?
And so for them to yank the corporate charter from doing business in Japan is an amazing thing. Thinking in terms of being a senator, prior to 9/11, Bush was actually very much on the ropes, and almost impeachment was in the air. Because of the corporate scandals, Enron, he was absolutely doing nothing to stop the hemorrhaging of the California economy, and then it was translating into the Arthur Andersen scandal. Many of the major corporations, the blue chip stocks, were having to be revalued. If I understand right, General Motors had to restate their value by sixfold. So they were truly worth 16% of what they claimed to be. And Shell, for example, had to restate by threefold. They were truly worth 32-33% of what they claimed. So that knocked out a huge amount of collateral, and obviously we had an enormous victory. You know, our corporate the corporate hellions that are decimating the world were all of a sudden very much on the ropes, and 9/11 took that issue completely off the screens. And it's kind of interesting that the stock market is It's dropped in the last day or so, but Bush's claim that the stock market has been rising, you know, magnificently, well, it's been rising, you know, relative to this huge bottom that they fell out of. So it's, I'm just wondering what you would, you know, looking at the aspects of corporate crime, and now it's becoming much more visible, what would you look at in terms of being a senator and dealing with either organized crime or corporate crime in these issues?
The worst thing about corporate crime is that almost everything the corporations do is perfectly legal. You can lay off hundreds of thousands of people, you can rob their pension funds, you can steal their children's future, and that's all perfectly legal. Even having said that, though, they even sometimes break their own laws. And this is really something that I think we have to take into account and figure out what we're going to do about. Because I think that, for instance, Enron, I think now two guys are going to serve 18 months for the whole Enron scandal. And it, really, they are bit players in the whole corporate crime. So I think there's two levels. One is when they get caught literally with their hands in the cookie jar, lying to take money from ordinary people, they should be held to account. And I think having 100 CEOs serving life in prison without possibility of parole would be a good example and would be a good beginning to sort of clamping down on corporate crime. Never happened under this system. But there's another whole class of corporate crime, which is, again, what I said about everything that's just legal. Busting unions, destroying pension funds, it's all legal. General Motors spun off Delphi, its parts, auto parts plants, and now they are coming back to the union, and they want a two-thirds wage cut. Or they say, we're going to move all our plants overseas, which is, by the way, a lie. They're going to move them to South Carolina, where there's no unions. And so we have, and that should be, in my opinion, a crime. So what is crime under this system? Crime is generally determined by the people who have money, and they determine that crimes are anything that risk their money. And if you look at what, so there's two types of crime. There's the crime of the poor people, and so you can't rob, you can't strike, you can't do anything which at all threatens the wealthy people. And those are a lot of the set of laws we have in the United States. And those are why most people are in prison. So the drug war, the property crimes, the violence which is created in communities so that people take it out on each other, all of those things are one type of crime which is defined by the rich people in the society, and they use it to lock up millions of people every year. There's another type of crime in which rich people make rules amongst themselves about how you are supposed to take from other rich people and how you're not supposed to take from other rich people. And so that's mostly what the Enron scandal is about. Those people are not in prison today because they robbed the pension funds. They're in prison today because they lied to the other capitalists about how they were taking the pension funds. So corporate crime, I think, is really falls into two categories. There's theft versus the other corporations, which is just, there's probably a million lawyers in the United States who spend every day suing other corporate lawyers over how to get this market share or that patent or this thing. And largely, I think that that we have very little influence over that. And then there's the laws which they use against all the ordinary people, against poor people, against workers, against unions, against immigrants, against women, against students. And so corporate crime really comes in those two categories. I think what we should do as a senator is to say, for instance, on the second category of sort of poor people crimes, that we have to abolish the drug war, that we have to get rid of these ridiculous mandatory third strike sentences for nonviolent crime, that legalization of many categories of drugs would go a long ways towards eliminating a huge amount of violence, and then of course pairing that with massive funding for drug rehab and counseling and programs and job opportunities, and that really that so we have to get rid of a lot of those reactionary laws which target poor people, but we also have to implement positive laws which would also get rid of a whole bunch of crime. So for instance, a living wage. If you look, I come from Oakland. In Oakland, the murder rate this year is about twice as high as it was last year. The reason is because unemployment's gone back up. The only thing that determines how many murders there are in Oakland and in most major cities in the United States is the unemployment rate. Doesn't matter how many cops are on the street, doesn't matter the community policing versus them being a cruiser. What matters is how many people are unemployed, and that is the best marker you have of hopelessness and despair and anger. And the higher the unemployment rate goes, the more people just crack and start to fight with each other, and that's why the murder rate goes up. So a living wage, national health care, those two things would, I think, probably cut the murder rate in half in the United States in about 6 months. But then we also have to have positive laws that I would put forward, or proposals put forward in the United States Senate. And the one that I push a lot is this. And this is kind of hard to get your head around. But think about this. You know what the federal education budget is, right?
Well, it's rapidly falling. I'm not sure the number.
It's about $70 billion per year. And it's gone up 5% and down 5% adjusted for inflation over the last 10 years. It's basically $70 billion a year. And, of course, the Pentagon budget, depending on how you want to count it, but let's say it's $550 billion per year. Because that it's $450 billion officially plus the $120 billion to fight the wars, which is a strange distinction to make. But that's not even counting what they use for the nuclear weapons in the Department of Energy. It's not even counting the Homeland Security. It's not counting all the other weapons programs they have off the books. So let's just say $550 billion a year for the defense budget. If you just take the education budget and the defense budget and you switch them, what does that do? That still leaves the United States with the largest military budget in the world, twice as big as China's military budget. So the idea that Canada would somehow invade and overrun us is really could be easily dispelled. So a mere $70 billion, which basically you use to double the salaries of the soldiers, and you cut all of the ridiculous Star Wars programs. And then what could you do with $550 billion in the education budget? Well, this is pretty astounding, because we're often told, oh, budget crunch, we don't have any money, we all have to tighten our belts, you know, you can't just throw money at the problem. Well, let's try this mental exercise of throwing some money at the problem. So for $550 billion a year, you could spend $70 billion, and with $70 billion, doubling the federal education budget, you could hire 1.5 million public school teachers at $50,000 a year benefits and salaries. That is a 100% increase in the number of teachers in the United States today. So you cut all of the classrooms in half, and you give 1.5 million people good union-paying, union-wage jobs with full benefits, and you take a huge chunk out of employment. And not just McDonald's jobs, you know, for $6.75 an hour type employment, but a real job with a real future doing something that people would love to do. And I bet if you offered that deal to the soldiers in the United States Army, about two-thirds of them would take it. So that's $70 billion. For $200 billion, we could build 10,000 schools in the United States. And that would, again, about double the number of schools. We could make those schools in every community. We could use environmentally sustainable, renewable energy, the most modern construction techniques in terms of the relationship between the earth and construction. We can employ an army of construction workers and use school building as a way to leverage environmentally sustainable and sane construction techniques into a whole new industry in the United States. And the last thing you could do is you'd take another $200 billion and you give every graduating senior in the country a full scholarship to state university for 4 years. So that's the choice we have to make. Do we want to go around the world pummeling other countries and massacring people in Iraq and Afghanistan and threatening Venezuela, etc.? Or do we want to flood our communities with hope and with jobs and with healthcare and with education? And if you did that, and that would be the central theme I would push in the United States Senate, is to switch the education and military budgets. And of course, having $70 billion a year means that we have to get out of Iraq now, and we have to get out of Afghanistan now, we have to stop supplying all of the Middle Eastern regimes with all of their arms, we have to stop funding Israel to $3 billion a year for free, and we have to take all that money and put it to work in a massive education reform. And I think if you threw money at the problem like that, that it would transform the United States, and it would transform what other people in the world think of the United States. And so that's the central thing in terms of, I think that that's a positive proposal, which is about how to take care of national and international corporate crime.
Yeah, well, it hugely makes sense. I think, what do they say, that for every $1 million spent in peacetime, you're going to create 100,000 jobs. And or maybe it's, is it a billion? There's this ratio of, if you put it into military spending, you're going to create something like 70 jobs. You create, with the same dollar value, you're going to create 100,000.
You know what? You know what percentage of the Pentagon budget goes towards paying rank and file soldiers?
Yeah, it's what, 2%?
It's like 8%. I mean, you know what the starting pay for a private? You go and join the Army today, and you get shipped out to Iraq. If you're a private in the Army, your starting pay is a little over $16,000 a year. Then you get a little bit of extra combat pay. So for literally the same amount of money you could make working at McDonald's, you get to go learn how to carry an M16 and then all the mythical job training, et cetera. So really, it's an enormous scam. It's incredible. I mean, a third of our federal budget, third of our federal budget is just being handed to four or five defense contractors.
Sure. That's why I raised organized crime.
Exactly.
You know, these are the same people that are using PR spin to attack some of the poorest countries in the world. Afghanistan was, my God, you know, they said that even the generals didn't want to bomb there because it was a $1 million missile to blow apart a wood stick shack. And they had nothing left to blow up after the Russians were through there, and God knows, you know, Yugoslavia was so mineral rich that it was the mining industry that was vastly interested in Yugoslavia, and same with the pipelines that are going to be flowing out of Iraq. I mean, it's solely an organized crime scam. The it's good you raised the drug war. The 4 years right now, May is harvest time for opium in Afghanistan, and we've now had 4 years of the
crop
biggest,
is doing very well this year.
Yeah, that's right.
The
four of the biggest crops in the history of the world in Afghanistan. That heroin has got to be hitting the street somewhere. And the only thing I can think of is if they're not going to bring it over here to the United States, they're going to take it over to China and do another 85 years of keeping Chinese as junkies to keep them in slavery. So
a lot of it goes to Russia now, too. A lot of it is to the economic disaster in Russia and to Eastern Europe and to Europe. So it's the hypocrisy is just overwhelming. While we are defoliating the poorest peasants in Latin America's poppy crops in the Andes, because the only reason they grow it is because there's some way to get enough money to feed your kids. It's not because there's some conspiracy of indigenous peasants in the Andean mountains who want somehow to flood our communities with cocaine and crack. It's because it's the only way to survive. And again, with just a little bit of money, with the tiniest investment into healthcare, into food, into sustainable agriculture in those regions, without even noticing that they were missing $5 billion from the Pentagon budget, if we just diverted that towards sustainable agriculture in the Andes, then there would be no more poppy production because people would be able to feed themselves and would rather do that. And it's a dangerous crop and et cetera, et cetera. So I think that the drug war is just one of these just enormous hypocrisies. And you take it to California. In 1970, there were 25,000 people in California prisons. Today, there are 165,000 in a period in which the state population has doubled or so. So we have increased the prison population eightfold, while the state's population has only increased by onefold or twofold, however you say that. It's doubled. But this enormous police war, this enormous drug war, is really failing dramatically at all levels except for one level, which is that, you know, as you mentioned, the stock market's doing quite well. Corporate profits are doing very well. The minimum wage adjusted for inflation is at a historical low. More people are losing their health care. So for some people in the United States, all of this works extremely well. And we should not fall into the mistake of believing that they push this stuff because they are naive. The two major parties, the Democrats and the Republicans, know exactly what they're doing. When Dianne Feinstein votes to send our troops to Iraq, when she votes to privatize our schools through the No Child Left Behind, when she is opposed to national health care, when she's opposed to gay marriage, and now when she is pushing legislation that will literally lead to the division of Latino immigrant families in California by deporting millions of people across the border, and by putting guard troops there, they know exactly what they're doing. And they are actually a pretty good deal for the people who pay them. So Dianne Feinstein has $10 million in her campaign chest, which is seems like a lot of money to you and me. But to the people who give her that money, that's just chump change. It's a very good deal to buy a senator for $10 million. I mean, there's only 100 of them. So getting one of them, and PG&E, Qualcomm, and The Gap are her three biggest contributors, PG&E getting Dianne Feinstein for $100,000 is a pretty good deal. I mean, if I think we could probably put together 100 friends, and if we could buy a senator for $100,000, we'd try to do it. So there is these two parties know exactly what they're doing, and this is why I think it's important for people to concentrate not on me as a personality or anything, but on the challenge that the Green Party represents to these two mainstream parties and other third parties as well. Because American capitalism and the two-party system are not sort of optional happenstances that happen to occur at the same time. That the way this political system runs works extremely well for the richest people in this country. They are very happy that they have two parties, which they absolutely control. And they are absolutely hostile, viciously hostile to any challenge to that authority. You only have to look at what happened to Ralph Nader in 2004. When he ran, the Republicans actually sort of left him alone. It was the Democrats who went crazy. They filed frivolous lawsuits. They intimidated petition gatherers. They said to him, "You do not have the right to be on the ballot." They didn't say, "Don't vote for you because I think our candidate's better." Nobody said John Kerry is better than Ralph Nader. I mean, a few people did, but nobody made that argument. They said, even though John Kerry is for the war, even though he's a corporate shill, even though et cetera, et cetera, we still think you don't have the right to be on the ballot because we live in a two-party system. And so I think that the challenge the Green Party represents, and it's at the national level but also at the local level, so we have Ross Mercuremi on the Board of Supervisors here in San Francisco. Amy Allison is running in Oakland and has a very good chance to become the first Green Party counselor in Oakland, and people should check out amyallison.org, her website there. Gail McLaughlin is running for mayor up in Richmond, a Green Party member. And so I think that the Green Party has to challenge this two-party system at every level, from the national to the federal to the state to the local. And we shouldn't be under any illusions that this is going to be an easy battle. For instance, IRV. I don't think the Democratic Party is ever going to give in to IRV, or at least it won't without a tremendous fight, because the moment they give in to instant runoff voting or proportional representation, then immediately half of the people who vote for the Democratic Party will start voting for the Green Party. Now, we saw that in Matt Gonzalez's race against Gavin Newsom. It took the Democrats and the Republicans combined to beat Matt Gonzalez. So the Democrats, if anything, are even more obsessed with making sure that there are no electoral reforms, because they will be the ones that will lose dramatically to parties to their left, and especially the Green Party. So you still have until May 22nd to register in the Green Party to vote on the June 6th primary. And I think that everybody who can hear this, if you're not already registered, you should go out and do it. Make sure to vote in the June 6th primary. The Senate campaign is actually a contested primary within the Green Party, and I think that's very healthy. There's not really a contested primary in the Senate race for the Democrats or Republicans. There's only one Republican running, and Dianne Feinstein has been anointed by the powers that be. So there's no democracy within their primaries. Within our primary, there's three people running. And you can check out, does Kent Messplay from San Diego, Tian Harder from Santa Clara, and me from Oakland. We've all got websites. Mine is toddforsenate.org. And you should go and check out the websites and see who you think would be the best candidate. And if you are a registered Green, make sure to go out and vote on June 6th, because a lot of people are not so clear about how the primary works. There really is a contested primary, and whoever gets the most votes in the Green Party contested primary will be the candidate. So it really behooves people who are registered or would like to register in the Green Party to check out the different candidates and to make their own decision, but to definitely get out and vote.
Good, good. Now, have you also, if you want volunteers to join with your campaign, if you certainly can go to the website, what did you say, toddforsenate.org?
Yeah, it's toddforsenate.org, which is Todd, T-O-D-D, the number 4, senate.org, and you can register online there, and we'll get in touch with you, or you can call 510-590-590. 6073 if you'd like to get in touch with me directly. And this is a campaign which is not going to be run by money. This is a campaign which is going to be run by people power. So we really do encourage people to call up and volunteer. And maybe the last thing I'll say just in closing real quick is I think that Dianne Feinstein is vulnerable. She cannot be beaten from the right in California. She can only be challenged from the left. And so I'm asking people to volunteer and to for my campaign and to vote for my campaign on June 6th in the primary, because I think that I can put together a statewide aggressive campaign in every county in this state and challenge Dianne Feinstein. And our goal is to win 1 million votes for peace. And we feel like if we can do that, it will send a message to the mainstream of the Democratic Party that they cannot take the immigrants' rights movement for granted, they cannot take the peace movement for granted, they cannot take the labor movement for granted, and that it is time we stood up and declare our independence from these two mainstream parties. So hope you get out there and vote for me on June 6th, and I really appreciate the chance to come in and talk to you all.
All right. Yeah, thanks again, Todd. So again, you've been listening to Todd Kreshen. He's one of the three candidates for U.S. Senate here in California. He's running against Dianne Feinstein. She's been senator for, what, four?
1992.
Since 1992. Yeah. Endless. As a matter of fact, it's kind of interesting. If I understand right, she was on the Board of Supervisors here in San Francisco at the time that Harvey Milken, George Moscone were murdered, and she was actually considered dead in the water. She was considered a useless supervisor even for, what was that, 1979 or something like that. She was dead in the water. She was a lame duck. She was useless, and she was not reelectable, and it was only because of the murder of those two that she was elevated. I guess she had seniority, and that's why she was elevated to mayor. And then, with the 1982 Democratic Convention in San Francisco, she was able to catapult herself to become the Senate race. And it, simply sort of like 9/11 for George Bush. He was slumped in the polls before 9/11, and it was solely because of the murder of Moscone and Milk that she got enough television airtime that gave name recognition for her Senate race back then. So she's never been respected as a politician. It was simply because the rest of the state knew nothing about her. So very interesting. All right. Well, we thank you, and good luck with the race, and then on to November.